Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We talk about China a lot here, and a man who I think brings some fresh thought practically daily to the topic of China, of what it is up to, what the Chinese Communist Party intends to do to us, and what we had best be doing about all of that, is our first guest. His name is Dr. Bradley Thayer. He is a founding member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China. He is an author of numerous books, including a forthcoming one, I'm pleased to say. The most recent of them, I think, is How China Sees the World, Han Centrism, and the Balance of Power in International Politics. And we're going to talk with him a bit about that Han centrism business. Brad Thayer, it's always good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. It's my great pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Let me ask you about this phenomenon. The Chinese Communist Party has, I think, a persistent question of its legitimacy. It's done horrific things to its people over the course of its domination of them. It has been, of course, somewhat successful, I think, frankly, thanks to financing from us in no small measure, in lifting many of them out of poverty. But you've written recently, I think at Epoch Times, about this question of whether or not the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP, is determined to maintain its legitimacy and its control of its people by appealing to this sort of Han culture, civilization, well, centrism, supremacism, perhaps, if you wish. Talk a bit about that, if you would.
Thank you, Frank. This is an extremely important issue because the Chinese Communist Party is illegitimate as a governing force, as a polity. The Chinese Communist Party is adopting a Western ideology, not a Chinese ideology, but a Western ideology of Marxism, Leninism, Stalinism, through Mao, to oppress the Chinese people and to export that odious ideology around the world. And so we need to recognize first that the Chinese Communist Party is adopting a non-Chinese ideology, a Western ideology, to oppress the Chinese people. It also works to buttress the fact that it is illegitimate by making the appeals to the greatness of Chinese civilization, of Han civilization, for many thousand years. One of the world's greatest civilizations, of course, with fundamental contributions in technology, science, literature, art, philosophy, religion, which is innate, obviously, to China. The illegitimate Chinese Communist Party seeks to seize that and make appeals to it to, in fact, become Chinese when, in fact, it is not a Chinese entity. When we recognize that its ideology is Marxism as interpreted by Lenin, Stalin, and Mao. So it is fundamentally not Chinese and is fundamentally illegitimate.
You know, I'm so interested in this because I was involved, as you know, in a small way with President Reagan in his efforts to contend with and ultimately to defeat the last of those communist Marxist totalitarian states that sought the destruction of this country, namely the Soviet Union. And a key part of his strategy, which he insinuated into his speeches and his policymaking in any number of ways, was this idea of delegitimating the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the evil empire, the very odious and oppressive manifestation of communism in its day, as you say, both inside the USSR, elsewhere in the Warsaw Pact it controlled, and then wherever possible into other countries beyond. To the extent that that was, in fact, a key element of his successful strategy, Ronald Reagan's, Brad, are there lessons to be learned about what we should be doing to help delegitimate the Chinese Communist Party in this moment?
Absolutely, Frank. As you worked within the Reagan administration for many years, and you were really on the front line of those struggles, what the Reagan administration did, as you well know, is that they refused to recognize the legitimacy of the Soviet Union, recognizing that it was an oppressive and evil force, as he famously identified in his March 1983 speech, a very important speech which inspired so many people in the Soviet Union. Anatoly Sharansky, of course, has written after Reagan's death about how that speech inspired him, that he recognized that the lies were over, Leninism was dead, and here you had a Western leader speaking the truth about the Soviet Union. So for those in the gulag, it was inspiring. And we need to keep that in mind, that similarly, there are so many oppressed within China. We need leadership that will call attention to the fact that the Chinese regime is illegitimate, to sustain that message over time, to enlist our friends, allies, like-minded people around the world in that effort, and to inspire the Chinese people so that they can recognize the rest of the world is there to assist them, is sympathetic, and is there to assist them working to overthrow the Chinese Communist Party, this illegitimate polity, as the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was delegitimized ultimately and overthrown. We need to work from within China as well as outside China.
Bloodlessly, we might add as well, thank God. Let me ask you about a movement that I've learned a bit about lately, Brad Thayer, that contributes, I think, to this effort to delegitimate the Chinese Communist Party. It's something called Tuidong, and it has at its core the idea of facilitating public renunciations, usually anonymous, though, of course, given what the party would do to anybody who does this openly, but people professing they no longer want to have anything to do with the CCP. Tell us a little bit about this movement and whether this is a force to be, worked with to that shared purpose of trying to liberate the people of China from the predations of this odious totalitarian communist system.
Frank, it's a significant movement that, if you will, twists the dragon's tail of the Chinese Communist Party. We need to recognize that there are many movements, religious movements within China, political movements, elements in civil society, which do not accept the legitimacy of the party, and within their tight constraints are expressing their loathing of the regime and a desire to eliminate it. So we can see throughout China there are movements like this, which, as you well note, are extremely brave, given the fact that the Chinese regime very actively suppresses and punishes those who are seen as malcontents or essentially ideological enemies.
And yet I'm told that there is something on the order of 300 to 400 million people who have lent their names or their pseudonyms, at least, to this Tuidong movement. So there's something there, that's for sure. We have to take a quick break. We're going to come right back with more with Dr. Bradley Thayer on the other side of a short break. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Sweden and Finland have just been admitted to NATO, bringing fresh forces and capabilities to bear at a critical moment. And Tom Cruise is uplifting millions of patriotic Americans and others still rooting for our country with his Top Gun sequel, Maverick. That's the good news. The bad news is that the U.S. military that is the backbone of the NATO alliance, and that is currently being portrayed so evocatively by Hollywood, is in serious trouble. Leading indicators are the dramatic shortfalls in recruitment being experienced at the moment by most of the armed services. Factors like Biden's Afghan debacle, inflation, personal pronouns, the priority given to critical race indoctrination and ideological purges, and forcing out healthy warriors unwilling to take COVID vaccines are destroying readiness, confidence in the uniformed leadership, and eligible candidates' willingness to serve. Such unforced errors imperil America. This is Frank Gaffney. We're back. We're going to continue this really timely conversation with one of the most thoughtful men I know on the whole threat posed to us by the Chinese Communist Party and its ambitions to not only dominate the world, but to get rid of the United States as a key impediment to realizing that larger ambition. Bradley, we were talking yesterday with Gordon Chang a bit about some shared concerns that we have about the degree to which the Chinese are now taking steps that seem, well, especially in light of their rhetoric, towards Taiwan, towards the region, towards us, for that matter, to be, well, putting China on a war footing. And I'm thinking here particularly of their efforts to both corner the market on very important components of modern economic life. I'm thinking of things like rare earth minerals and energy, uranium, fertilizers, and even food, which, as Gordon has pointed out, is now being weaponized by the Chinese, and maybe even more so going forward if there's real famine in the world, as seems now in prospect. But I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. Do you see this as of a piece with kind of getting China on a war footing for the kind of kinetic war that they seem now to have in mind?
Frank, I think that certainly is the case. And under Xi Jinping, for years, China, he has been moving China towards a war footing because he's determined to confront the United States in a kinetic manner, as well as, of course, as China has been doing in the ideological and the diplomatic and the economic realms. Since they came to power in 1949. So we should not be surprised by this, but it is alarming, particularly because we're slow on the uptake. And that is deterrence. Our deterrence of China is dependent on two fundamental categories. Military capabilities are absolutely necessary for deterrence, conventional or nuclear deterrence. Our military capabilities are not what they should be in the Indo-Pacific. And we need to increase our conventional presence, as well as, of course, our strategic presence, our nuclear presence at the tactical level, at a theater level, and at the strategic level. But deterrence is also dependent upon political variables, right? Political considerations are absolutely essential for deterring China. This includes resolve, it includes willpower, it includes credibility, so that when the United States issues a threat, for example, perhaps to protect Taiwan, to protect allies or other states, that it is a credible threat, that it is believed. And so the Biden administration, of course, is not what we would want to have in terms of being able to be an administration which is able to convince all audiences in China, the Chinese leadership, our allies, other states who are opposed to us, and other states who wish us well, that we are going to live up to any type of commitment that we make to deter Chinese aggression.
So it's you know, I want to just say that your contribution to an excellent webinar that our Committee on the Present Danger China conducted, I think it was almost 2 weeks ago now, Brett Thayer, on this question of how not to deter China, was really incredibly important. And you can take a look at that video with Brad Thayer and Steve Mosher and Captain Jim Fennell at presentdangerchina.org. And I strongly urge you to do so. Brad, let me just switch gears slightly. In connection with this war footing that the Chinese seem to be about, we've been hearing increasing concerns about their Belt and Road Initiative, as it's been called. I was interested, Gordon was somewhat dismissive of it, arguing that it's proven to be a terrible financial burden to the Chinese Communist Party, even though I think, frankly, most of that money's come from us rather than from their coffers, but that it's underwriting a lot of uneconomic infrastructure development, and it's saddling them with debt, and it's otherwise not working out as the sort of influence operation at a minimum that the Chinese clearly had in mind. What's your take on this Belt and Road Initiative, as it's been called? And then we'll talk a little bit about this alternative that the West has come up with.
Well, Frank, I see the Belt and Road Initiative as having three strategic objectives for China. There is the military objective for China. There's an economic one. And then there's the ideological one. So the Belt and Road Initiative is really those three things for the Chinese regime. I think Gordon is exactly right on the economic one. It has been a bit of it's been problematic for China, but that's only one of the objectives. We need to recognize that it is a geostrategic military project undertaken by the party as well to establish military and intelligence bases as well as political influence around the world. So there, I do not think it has been a failure. There, I think it has been a success despite recent issues, for example, and the war in Ukraine. It is also ideological. It is conveying to the rest of the world that China is the future. It's the Chinese economy. It's the Chinese political force, the polity, the regime that the Chinese possess, which is the future of international politics. And all states should get on board, essentially, this effort in support of the Chinese Communist Party. So when we think about the Belt and Road Initiative with those objectives, we can see that it has been much more of a success in the military, intelligence, geostrategic project, and in the ideological effort that it has been. And that, I think, helps to explain not only that we're funding it, but why the Chinese are willing to accept short-term economic losses. Because it's not a profit-generating enterprise. It's a strategic and ideological.
Exactly. I definitely agree with that. And I just would also say, Brad, that to the extent that infrastructure lends itself to the military power projection capabilities of the Chinese Communist Party over time, at least, I'm not sure that it's going to actually prove to be a bad investment, even economically. But that, of course, will be measured in terms other than just the sheer financial one. Lastly, let me ask you quickly about this plan or the program for global infrastructure and investing that the West has conjured up, some $600 billion is being pledged for it. What do you make of this, Brett Thayer, and do you think it represents a real alternative to and something that will undermine this Belt and Road Initiative of China?
Well, Frank, I think it's an important step forward, but it's also overdue. This should have been executed 20 years ago, long before the Belt and Road Initiative was up at the Digital Silk Road, Silk Road or Digital Silk Road, as the Chinese were calling it, about 10, 15 years ago, as they were conceiving of it. We should have been doing this a long time ago. And that is, again, we're always on the back foot. The Chinese are moving ahead, and we're responding with this enterprise. It's a significant one, and I'd echo Gordon's comments that he made yesterday on this program with respect to it. It's important, but it also reveals that we are only now doing steps that we should have taken a very long time ago.
Indeed. And even then, we're talking about investing in climate change and equity issues, which may or may not be of great interest to the countries in question, let alone as important to them as some of that infrastructure the Chinese have on offer. We have to leave it at that. Brad Thayer, for today, this is a really important conversation, very timely. As always, we appreciate yours and look forward to having a chance to visit with you again in the near future. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm anxious to talk further about the challenge that we're facing from China, particularly in the military space, which happens to pretty much cover everything, because the Chinese, as I think we've talked about on many occasions, have a doctrine of civil-military fusion that means that essentially everything that they do is in the service of advancing their military capabilities, the People's Liberation Army. There is no better expert in the world, as far as I'm concerned, than our next guest. His name is Richard Fisher. He is a senior fellow of the International Assessment and Strategy Center. He is a voluble contributor to the public policy debate about what the Chinese Communist Party is up to and what it means for us. He's always a welcome guest here. Rick, good to have you, albeit by phone today. We're glad to have at least the chance to talk with you. So thank you for taking the time, sir.
Thank you, Frank.
There was a recent test, Rick, of ballistic missile defense capabilities by the Chinese communists. They call it the sword and spear test. The threat against which they profess to be working is one of a modernized U.S. intercontinental ballistic missile, a ground-based missile that won't be in the inventory, I think, for some years now, and the possibility of shorter-range missiles being deployed to what's called by them the First Island Chain. Those aren't anywhere in sight that I'm aware of. But talk us through what the Chinese have demonstrated with this test and the grounds for doing so.
Certainly, Frank. This was the sixth acknowledged Chinese mid-course missile interception, meaning that the interception took place just above the atmosphere in space. During previous tests, the United States has accused China of conducting anti-satellite interception tests. So the system that is being developed, and it has been tested now for over a decade, is likely dual capable. It's capable of intercepting intercontinental ballistic missile warheads that are that the Chinese want to shoot down, and capable of intercepting satellites that the Chinese Communist Party, People's Liberation Army, is seeking to shoot down. This program to develop an anti-missile, anti-satellite capability goes back to the 1980s. And the system that is being tested is likely called the HQ-19. And it is a 3 to 4 stage derivative of the Dongfeng 21 medium range ballistic missile. The Chinese developed a company or created a company to build this missile back in the late 1990s, and were advertising this company at their early Zhuhai air shows. So it's been a long time coming, and now it is reaching an advanced state of capability at a time when China is vastly increasing the size of its nuclear missile arsenal. In my estimation, the Chinese could have about 4,000 warheads, 3 times the size of America's missile warhead arsenal by the end of this decade, earlier the next decade, and they are combining a robust national missile defense capability with nuclear superiority over the United States. Now, it's curious. For the last 40 years, the Chinese have been blasting the United States for its missile defense developments, just vicious attacks regularly. And now China...
To say nothing of their space activities.
Yeah, they're adopting the rhetoric of the Reagan administration. They want a defense against nuclear missiles. And so they've gotten away with gaslighting us, Frank. And now they're not just are they going to have the swords to attack us, they're going to have the shield to defend against us. Deterrence will break down.
Yeah, that's the big concern here, isn't it, Rick Fisher, that we've been watching a modernization program that is designed not for deterrence, but in fact for nuclear war fighting emerging from the Chinese Communist Party alongside all of these other conventional capabilities. And this brings me to a question that I always feel compelled to ask you about. You've sort of touched on it already in connection with this anti-satellite capability. But Rick, you've made as close a study of what the Chinese are doing, particularly in this civil-military fusion kind of context, in space. There's a report that I've just seen about them claiming that they will be the first to return samples from the Martian planet, beating us by some time in doing so. But how does this fit into the larger agenda of the Chinese Communist Party with both respect to this, well, as Danny Graham used to call it, high frontier, but also the impact that space has in terms of terrestrial domination, which, of course, is the purpose driving the Chinese Communist Party?
Well, yes, Frank. The news that China could return samples from Mars about 2 years before the United States would launch a mission to do that, provided, of course, that mission continues to be funded, is consistent with how the Chinese Communist Party views space. It views space as the ultimate high ground. And the power that has the most assets in space, has the most assets on the farthest possible bodies that can be reached, is the power that will control the Earth-Moon system, and in the future, the Earth-Moon-Mars system. Now, we've been hearing for a long time about how, in the next century perhaps, prosperity on Earth will be driven and eventually dependent on commercial mining, manufacturing activity in space, on the moon, and then Mars. The Chinese Communist Party wants to be able to control access to the moon and then to Mars. It does not want to have to depend on the goodwill of the United States. And when it achieves the position of being able to deny access to the moon and Mars to the United States, it will use that position to dominate conflict on Earth, to contain the United States, and eventually to undermine and destroy our democracy, just like they will undermine and destroy every other democracy. This is a fight to the finish, and the Chinese Communist Party does not have any structure, mental or biological, that compels it to live with another power. It wants to destroy all powers that would stand in its way.
Yeah. And Rick, this is what's so extraordinarily important about your research. You're able to connect the proverbial dots between the stated ambitions of the Chinese Communist Party for global domination, I guess one might even say interplanetary domination at that, with the programs that they're pursuing to actually facilitate and enable the realization of those ambitions. And it makes so vital, this analysis does, your critique of the shortcomings of our own capabilities in all of these regards. It's just vital that we be clear about this and take corrective action. And let me ask you about one thing that I gather is causing the Chinese considerable upset, and that is SpaceX, private sector initiative known as Starlink, thousands and thousands of satellites, which the Chinese evidently regard as something that might give us a resiliency in space that would be a problem for them. Speak to that in 30 seconds, if you could.
Certainly, Frank. The Chinese have spent the last three decades at least trying to dominate the internet on Earth, trying to control markets for servers and all the hardware for internet on Earth. And along comes Elon Musk with his Starlink constellation. He wants to put up 30, 40,000 satellites into low Earth orbit and essentially create what the Chinese fear will be an internet in space, that they cannot control, an internet in space that is already helping Ukraine to fight the Russian invasion, as it will likely also help Taiwan to fight the Chinese invasion. They hate this. They're afraid of it.
They are indeed, and that's a good thing as far as I'm concerned. Rick Fisher, we have to leave it at that. Thanks for the great work you do at the International Assessment and Strategy Center. Thank you for being a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and for your contributions to this program with some regularity. We hope we can get you back very soon. And in the meantime, thanks for joining us by phone today. Next up, we'll speak with George Raceley about the January 6th committee and other shenanigans in Washington right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Sweden and Finland have just been admitted to NATO, bringing fresh forces and capabilities to bear at a critical moment. And Tom Cruise is uplifting millions of patriotic Americans and others still rooting for our country with his Top Gun sequel, Maverick. That's the good news. The bad news is that the U.S. military that is the backbone of the NATO alliance and that is currently being portrayed so evocatively by Hollywood is in serious trouble. Leading indicators are the dramatic shortfalls in recruitment being experienced at the moment by most of the armed services. Factors like Biden's Afghan debacle, inflation, personal pronouns, the priority given to critical race indoctrination and ideological purges, and forcing out healthy warriors unwilling to take COVID vaccines are destroying readiness, confidence in the uniformed leadership, and eligible candidates' willingness to serve. Such unforced errors imperil America. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We're going to turn now to some very important matters here at home involving, well, the congressional branch, for one, and the judicial branch, actions and decisions that are being taken by both that have considerable implications, I think it's fair to say, for our country at a very, very difficult moment. A man whose judgment on all of these things and whose insights into them is informed by literally decades of experience in the executive branch, in the congressional branch, in elective campaigns, following closely as an attorney the judicial branch as well. He these days is the editor of Richard Viguerie's superb newsletter, Conservative HQ. His name is George Raceley. He is our resident genius, I'm fond of saying, and a dear friend of this program. We're always delighted to have a chance to catch up with him, especially at such a moment as this. George, welcome back to Securing America, sir.
Thanks for having me, Frank. Always a pleasure.
Let me ask you, first of all, about this January 6th Select Committee. You've written about it at Conservative HQ, of course. You have been, I know, following closely its work, including the hearing that it had yesterday with this aide to Mike Meadows when he was a chief of staff at the White House on the fateful day of January 6th, in fact. Give us sort of the general picture of what this committee is about, George, and tell us about what you made of yesterday's.
Well, you know, the committee is completely illegitimate. It doesn't follow the existing congressional rules for committees. It's really just a legislatively endorsed smear machine constructed by the Democrats. And yesterday's hearing, if you can call it that, with some random, you know, one step above an intern White House staffer was a perfect example of that. This young lady testified to all sorts of scurrilous charges, which are now all being knocked down. The Secret Service has said the core of her testimony is false. One of her White House colleagues has come forth and said, hey, wait a minute, the note that you claim was written by you in your handwriting was in fact written by me in my handwriting. And so, you know, these bombshells that this woman dropped are rapidly turning out to be duds.
Yeah. This is a gal by the name of Cassidy Hutchinson, who, as you say, was essentially a very low-level assistant to Mark Meadows. And she describes in this testimony of hers what Donald Trump did to try to commandeer his limousine known as the Beast. I've never been in it myself, George. I imagine you've been in presidential limousines in your previous incarnations, but I don't know how he could conceivably have done that. And he says he didn't, obviously, but from the back of a bulletproof encased shell with glass partitions, as I think is the case, this is just the stuff of absolute fantasy and well, ridicule.
Yes, yeah, I mean, I have been in the previous iterations of the Beast, and you know, even the really old Beast, and there's just absolutely no way. First of all, you know, the Secret Service opens the door for you getting in and getting out. The doors to the front cabin where the driver and the agent is are never opened for security purposes. And so, you know, that just tells me that as soon as I saw that, I said, this whole thing is made up.
Well, let me just ask you this then, George. Would one of the things that has characterized these show trials, kangaroo courts, whatever you want to call the escapades of this committee, has been the presentation of certain information without cross-examination, without challenge from members or counsel or anybody else, for that matter. A man who has been specifically targeted for this kind of smear campaign is a friend of both of ours by the name of John Eastman. Professor Eastman is a very distinguished legal scholar out of the Claremont Institute, and he's been terribly vilified by the committee. You've written about this at Conservative HQ. Tell us what we should make of what's been done to him and where the facts lie.
I mean, what's been done to John Eastman is an outrage against the entire Anglo-American legal tradition. We should all want lawyers like John Eastman, if we ever get in trouble, who are willing to examine the law, examine history, use all the tests that judges, particularly our Supreme Court, does to come to a conclusion on these issues and push it to its limits, to propose novel defenses, to reinterpret history. You want that to the benefit of your clients. And then judges and juries decide whether your presentation of the facts and law supports or does not support your case. And if we didn't have lawyers like John Eastman, we would have never had the advances in civil rights and many other areas of the law that we've had. I mean, challenging decisions like Plessy v. Ferguson, the separate but equal outrage that ruled education and public accommodations for about 50 years. So
that was held by Supreme Courts of several generations, I guess, as constitutional and meet and just under our law. It wasn't, and it had to be removed, as we will talk about a bit more on the other side of a short break with George Raceley. Some very important decisions taken by Justice Clarence Thomas and his colleagues, and just another word on John Eastman. Stay tuned for all of that right after this. We're back, and it's a pleasure to say we're joined by George Raceley, for a further conversation about this January 6th committee's vendetta against John Eastman and some very important Supreme Court rulings. John, just quickly before we turn to the court, John Eastman has basically been pilloried by the committee for having promoted unfounded, unconstitutional, ahistorical recommendations that did not meet the test of being within the law. He's not been given his day in this court, if you would, this Star Chamber. But what do we make of the merits of the arguments that he was advancing and the fitness, therefore, of the kinds of punishments that have already been sent his way in terms of his livelihood and even efforts to disbar him for
having sex. Yeah, well, let's begin with the premise that the process is the punishment and that Democrats are past masters at dragging their political enemies through these lengthy processes to bankrupt them, to destroy their family lives, destroy their reputations. And at the end of the process, if nothing happens, you've still been punished. And so John Eastman's arguments regarding the powers of the vice president have substantial historical and scholarly backup. They've never been tested in a court because the D.C. Uniparty did their very, very best to keep Trump out of court where he could have made those arguments. And so you can't really claim that Eastman was being disingenuous or anything like that when there's, you know, stacks and stacks of history and scholarship behind his allegations about the powers of the vice president.
Yeah, disingenuous is, of course, the least of it. They're claiming he was actually promoting seditious, insurrectionist, illegal activity. And this is crazy on its face. George, let me turn to the Supreme Court rulings. You are a very accomplished marksman and instructor, a man who knows his way around guns and the dangers of gun control to our constitutional rights to keep and bear arms. And I wanted to ask you about the ruling that Justice Clarence Thomas wrote for the majority of the court, 6-3, about gun ownership in the country and how that stacks up with what we've seen the Congress just enact with an effort to do something, as they say, about Uvalde and similar kinds of tragedies.
Well, I thought Justice Thomas's opinion in that case, the New York Rifle and Pistol Club case, was brilliantly argued. It's solidly based in a long, long string of Supreme Court decisions and our history. Our history is one of the things that these things are based on. And what Clarence concluded and the other justices agreed with was that the Second Amendment protects a pre-existing right. It, in essence, that's as close as the Supreme Court is probably ever going to come to endorsing the concept of a natural right. And I loved how he turned the despicable Democrat Chief Justice Roger Taney's Dred Scott decision back on the Democrats by pointing out that one of the reasons that Taney didn't want blacks to be citizens was because they would acquire the right to keep and bear arms if they were citizens.
Mm-hmm. Racism through and through. And it turns out that Justice Thomas is being subjected to a fair amount of that racism at the moment, it seems, notably in connection with a concurring opinion that he offered on the Dobbs case that overturned Roe versus Wade. Any thoughts on Justice Thomas's role at the moment and particularly this set of recommendations?
Justice Thomas is the conservative constitutionalist anchor of the court. His scholarship, his understanding of the law, and his willingness to be the outlier, like John Eastman, has brought the court a long way on a variety of different issues. Whether or not his view on substantive due process and gay marriage and all that kind of stuff will be more fully developed in a future case, I don't know. But he raised very important points, because once you start chipping away at judicial arrogance and all of these decisions that have no statutory basis or no basis in our legal or cultural traditions, suddenly as to say nothing of the Constitution, suddenly brings into question all this other judge-made law. And so these two decisions, in one sense, are very closely tied together in their rejection of judicial arrogance.
Yeah, strict constructionism, I guess, is what we're all about. George Raceley, thank you for this analysis. I did just want to say in closing, one of the other people who is being vilified by the January 6th committee and by its ilk is Clarence Thomas's wife, Ginny Thomas, who is a dear friend of both yours and mine, George, and much admired, I think, by all of us in the conservative movement. What is being done to her, both in her own right and as a way of getting at her husband, is a travesty. It is beneath contempt, and it must stop. And I very much pray that this will be the last we hear of such nonsense from the committee and from others as well. George, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for joining us periodically. Your insights are extremely important, and I know valuable to our audience as well as to me. I hope the rest of you found the whole program today to be very informative and helpful to you in figuring out how to help us protect the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and that you will, so equipped, go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.